You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the number of craft alcohol producers around Wisconsin has grown over the years, but those businesses can face some unique legal challenges when they're starting up. As part of WPR's High Tolerance series, we'll talk about what the law requires and what it may prevent them from doing. First, small wineries around the country are proving they can make a product people want to drink and socialize around. While the businesses can't always compete on the level of those, say, in California's Napa Valley, it turns out the upper Midwest has good soil and microclimates for grapes and fruits. In the next story in our series, High Tolerance, Patty Murray reports that wineries are having a multi-million dollar economic impact on Wisconsin.
Steve Johnson surveys his grapevines at Kewaunee's Parallel 44 Winery.
Even though from your mindset you're like, this is Wisconsin, this is like beer country, Packers, frozen tundra. Not wine country, but...
Johnson bought his 25-acre former cornfield near the shores of Lake Michigan in 2006. He now has 8,000 vines.
But we chose this place because, from a grape-growing perspective, it was the ideal spot because you need the proximity to the lake. And this is right on top of the escarpment. Actually, it's a form of gravel pit, so it's... I searched a lot of soil maps and chose this place, and I realized... It's a perfect place to grow grapes, but it's kind of off the beaten path. So,
Parallel 44 opens the doors of its tasting room to thirsty tourists on their way to or from Door County. Inside, the magic happens in the tank room.
These are what you call your fermentation aging vessels. So the key thing on these tanks is the banding on the sides. This is a coolant that runs around the perimeter of the...
As its name indicates, Parallel 44 is on the 44th parallel. If one traveled about 4,000 miles east, they would end up in the famous wine regions of Bordeaux or Tuscany. Johnson says the region's soils of the local geography, known as the Niagara Escarpment, are good for hybrid cold hardy grapes. And Wisconsin wines are drawing wine tourists. A 2016 study by Michigan State University found wine tourists spent nearly $50 million in 2015. Author Dan McColl is an associate professor of community sustainability at the school. He says those visitors aren't necessarily connoisseurs.
The quality of the wine doesn't need to be the highest. It doesn't need to rival France or California. It just needs to be good enough. And then people can have a very nice experience because some of the wineries in Wisconsin are quite beautiful, and they offer wonderful tasting room experiences for people who may never go to Napa or, you know, to the Loire Valley of France.
McColl's study also showed wineries provide employment to people in rural areas where manufacturing and other industries have shut down. A 2013 study done by UW Extension showed Wisconsin provides more than 700 wine-related jobs. Ripon, once known as Cookie Town, is an example. Two cookie factories closed in 2015 and 2016. The Vines and Rushes Winery planted its first vines in 2007 in Ripon. Owner Ryan Prelwitz says he now produces up to 70,000 bottles a year. Prelwitz is also president of the Wisconsin Winery Association. He says there are around 100 wineries statewide.
There's easier ways to make money than owning a winery. One of the old jokes in the industry is the only way to make a small fortune in the wine industry is to start with a large one. And so there's easier businesses to run than something that's as vertically integrated as this one.
But that hasn't stopped wineries from growing. And more established alcohol interests in the state haven't always been welcoming. Wisconsin's powerful Tavern League has opposed letting tasting rooms stay open past 9 p.m., which wineries say hurts their ability to host weddings and other events. Prelwitz says even though Wisconsin has that beer state reputation, there are just as many people who want the fruit of the vine and a growing number of businesses that want to provide it. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about that story and see the rest of our series High Tolerance at WPR.org/alcohol. Now, wineries, distilleries, and craft brewers face unique legal requirements as part of Wisconsin's three-tiered legal system. Many small producers have lobbied for changes in the law to make their part of the industry less costly and confusing. Jeffrey Glazer is an attorney at Ogden, Glazer & Schaefer in Madison and an expert on Wisconsin's alcohol laws. He's also a clinical assistant professor in the UW Law and Entrepreneurship Clinic. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we heard from our own Sean Johnson about the three-tiered system yesterday, but give us the rundown in a nutshell. What does it mean for people who make, distribute, and sell alcohol products?
I think in general it means that if you do one, you're not supposed to do the others, or you're supposed to do them in a very limited sense. So it tries to create a distinction between manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers.
And that's creating problems, as I understand it, for a lot of these craft breweries, wineries, distilleries out there. What kind of challenges do you see that creating for them?
The biggest challenges are that it's very inconsistently applied across the different kinds of manufacturing types, right? So the rules that apply to breweries don't apply to wineries and distilleries, and the rules that apply to wineries are very different from the rules that apply to breweries or brew pubs even. So, you know, just because one manufacturer can do it doesn't necessarily mean another manufacturer can.
So if somebody's out there thinking, yeah, this sounds great, I want to start up a brewery, winery, or distillery, on the legal side of things, what kind of things should they be thinking about?
Well, I think the biggest challenge in manufacturing is finding somebody to buy your product, right? Sort of the easiest way to guarantee somebody to be able to buy your product is to sell it at your manufacturing facility, right? And we know these as tap rooms or tasting rooms or brew pubs or whatever, right? But if you're trying to sell it somewhere other than your own location, getting your product to the retail facility can be a challenge, and there are different rules depending on whether you're a brewery or a brew pub or a winery or a distillery for how you can do that.
Now, one specific area that some wineries are concerned about is operating hours, as sure. I understand it. What's going on there?
So for some reason, wineries have to close by 9 p.m. They are the only manufacturer that has to be closed by 9 p.m. So an example of sort of inconsistent application of rules or an inconsistent set of rules. It's not really clear sort of from a policy perspective why wineries should have to close at 9, but it ended up in the law somehow. And so there it is. Now wineries have to be closed at 9, which means their tasting rooms have to close at 9. Although, interestingly, if they're serving beer, they don't have to stop serving beer at 9, but they have to stop serving their own product. They have to stop serving wine at 9.
Talking to attorney Jeffrey Glazer. He's a clinical assistant professor in the UW Law and Entrepreneurship Clinic, talking about some of the legal wrinkles facing Wisconsin's smaller wineries, distilleries, and breweries. Jeffrey, I understand there was a state commission that got together last year to try to hash some of these things out. What came out of that?
That's a really interesting question. I think the jury's still out on that, to be perfectly honest. I think it got a lot of people in a room together, but I think largely, you know, from an outsider's perspective, I was not a part of that commission. From an outsider's perspective, though, it seemed like it was a lot of people talking at each other and not necessarily with each other.
There are a lot of powerful lobbies at play here, right? I mean, the distributors, the retailers, and now this growing group of more and more people involved in being producers here in the state. How do you see the balance shifting over the years?
Yeah, I think the producers have done a great job of getting organized. I think there were some wake-up calls that have happened over the last few years in terms of legislation not really going their way. So I think the Brewers Guild has sort of led the effort in organizing all three guilds, so the Brewers Guild, the Winery Association, and the Distillers Guild. And together, they've now formed a craft beverage coalition, which can lobby on behalf of all three manufacturers, on behalf of the manufacturing tier, so that they can have their interests represented against the wholesalers and the Tavern League and you know, whatever.
And that said, do you expect any big changes or shakeups in Wisconsin's guiding laws when it comes to alcohol manufacturing, sales, and distribution, in our lifetimes?
In our lifetimes, yeah. In our lifetimes, I expect there to be some change. In the near future, I don't know. I can only hope. If they're asking for my opinion, I have some thoughts. It's not clear anything's going to change, you know, in the next, you know, near future.
Leave us with one change you'd like to see.
I would love to see all three tiers have self-distribution capability, or all three manufacturing types, breweries, wineries, distilleries, have self-distribution. Currently, distilleries can't self-distribute at all, and wineries have to go through this weird sort of paper distributor called a co-op, which just really doesn't make any sense at all, while breweries are allowed to self-distribute up to, you know, if you're a brewery almost the size of New Glarus, you can self-distribute. So I think getting some parity there would really help the startup wineries and distilleries in particular.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeff, thanks for coming up today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Jeffrey Glazer, attorney at Ogden, Glazer & Schaefer in Madison, with us to talk about some of the legal challenges faced by craft breweries, wineries, and distilleries. Museums have a lot to offer, a place to learn about science, history, art, and more, but they can also be economic drivers for their communities. That's the focus of this year's Creative Economy Week, hosted by Arts Wisconsin and the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. It's happening now, and it's being marked by events in cities around the state. Ann Katz is the executive director of Arts Wisconsin. Full disclosure, she's also a board member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. And welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about Creative Economy Week. It's in its fourth year. What's the goal? What are you trying to highlight when we look at the creative economy?
How much time do I have? we're continuing to make the case that the arts are good for our souls, good for our economy, good for our children, good for our quality of life, good for everything in Wisconsin. And so Creative Economy Week is one of our promotional ways to do that. The League of Municipalities, which is a great partner because they're concerned with the health and well-being of Wisconsin and its communities and its people, just as we are. We have done a lot of different kinds of projects together, and the marketing director and I sat down a few years ago and said, what else can we do? Gail Sumi is her name. And so we came up with this week. And a lot of it is what we can share on social media. We have proclamations from cities and villages around the state. And what's really great is that organizations and communities come up with their own projects, and we get to promote them.
And let's get to the museums now. I think a lot of people will think of the benefits of museums, and they like them. They like what they learn there, but they don't necessarily think about the economic impact. What do we know about the role that museums can play in a local economy?
Well, like every aspect of the arts, museums are institutions that bring us joy, bring us information and education, and they add to the economy, because when people go to a museum, they park their car, they go out to eat, if they're visiting someplace, they might go shopping. They buy things at the museum. They look at the art and the things that are in the museum. And all of that adds up to an experience that not only, again, enriches our souls, but also helps a community stay vibrant. And so we, every year with Creative Economy Week, we focus on some aspect of the arts. We've done performing arts centers. We've done murals. This year it's museums. And I could just spend the next 10 minutes or more listing the many different kinds of museums we have in the state. But it's a great opportunity to promote what we do have.
And when you start listing museums, we don't need to do it here, but the main lesson, it seems to me, is there are a lot more museums in Wisconsin than I would have thought.
Oh, absolutely. We have arts, science, environmental, history, and all sorts of other children's and all sorts of other different kinds of museums. And they range from the Milwaukee Art Museum, which people have pretty much everybody knows in the state, to the Superior Public Museum, to the Northwoods Children's Museum in Rhinelander, the Door County Maritime Museum. Mm-hmm. The problem with only listing a few is that I'm going to forget
are you gonna leave
most
out? Yeah.
of them, and they're going to say, why didn't you mention me?
So how much can a smaller or mid-sized town build around a museum? Because in addition to the economic impact, are there kind of spillover businesses once you start luring people to say that downtown?
Absolutely. Any place that there is a museum or any other arts institution, there is activity. And it doesn't happen all at once. If you look at the Milwaukee Art Museum, if you look at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, if you look at the Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum, it's an economy that comes around that place, which is restaurants for people to go to before or after, shops, again, parking ramps, all the things that go into an institution. And so it is, we do have many museums in our big cities, but we also have many museums in our small communities. One of the places that we were just there 2 days ago, Gail and I, we were at the Rahr West Museum in Manitowoc, which is owned by the city of Manitowoc, and that's pretty rare. There are not very many of those. It's a jewel for Manitowoc. We had the mayor of Manitowoc actually talking about how wonderful it was that they had this museum in their small city. It has an outstanding art collection, and we got to tour the Youth Art Month exhibit with hundreds of artworks by kids from the Manitowoc area. So it's a great benefit for any size city.
Talking to Ann Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin. It's Creative Economy Week. We're talking about the economic impact of museums around Wisconsin. What kind of, you mentioned that a city-owned museum is fairly rare. What kind of public support from state and local governments are museums getting in Wisconsin?
Well, museums, like any other business, are incredibly good at figuring out how to keep their work going. Every museum has to make itself, has to be relevant to its community. So the thing about a museum is that there's not only the work inside the walls, but more and more museums around the state are extending the museum, museums without walls. And that means bringing programs to community, to out to communities, whether it's educational programs or other community programs. And, you know, the internet has made it possible for anyone to tour any museum anywhere. So, you know, there's a mixture of public-private funding. There's what we call earned income, which is everything from ticket sales to selling things in the gift shop. But like any business, museums are continually thinking about how to make people, get people interested in their product and then have people participate. I should also say that there have been studies about the economic impact of museums. And in 2016, Wisconsin museums contributed $137 million in tax revenue, including $45.9 million to state and local government. So it's not only that museums are providing this experience to learn about a topic, but they're also adding to the tax base. So it's an all-around package.
Do you see any challenges facing museums in Wisconsin these days?
Well, like any business, it's a matter of how to, again, stay relevant and be part of the community. I think that's every business, and whether it's for-profit or nonprofit, every institution has to make sure that it's serving the community and is relevant to the community. As I said, a museum has walls, and you want to get people into the building in a world where everybody is sitting in front of their computer. And you also want to extend the work that the museum brings to the community. So the challenges are those kinds of challenges that any, again, community resource is facing. But I will say that what I see from Wisconsin museums is that they're incredibly creative about doing that churn all the time.
On the wider subject of creative economies, we are in a budget year here in Wisconsin. What kind of things are you looking for, hoping for from lawmakers this year?
Well, we have been working for the last few years on a creative economy development program, which would be at the moment administered by the Wisconsin Arts Board, and it would fund economic development through the arts, and that's everything from a cultural district to a cultural plan to artist live workspace and their public-private partnership. Arts education, because we have to make sure that our kids are prepared for the 21st century workforce and the world they live in, and infrastructure so that we can make sure that our institutions continue. We have gotten great bipartisan support for this legislation. It's now sort of working its way through the legislature. It's a very interesting year, that's for sure. But we're really seeing a lot of support for this kind of 21st century development, so we're optimistic.
You mentioned workforce. Earlier on the show, we talked to a lawmaker who's working on a non-related plan aimed at keeping out-of-state students in Wisconsin after they graduate from college. Do you see the availability of creative economy outlets, of attractions like museums and others as part of that effort?
Oh, absolutely. You know, people want to live, work, and play in places that have a lot of things to do, that have things for their kids to do, that have everything from arts to zoos, you know, libraries, parks, bike bike paths. And they people want that. And if they don't have it in their community, they'll go find it somewhere else. So the amenities in a community, which a museum is part of, are definitely part of the community development mix. Plus, the arts are important in a community because the arts help people be creative. They be problem solvers, work as a team, work independently. And all of those are skills that our 21st century workforce needs, whatever job they're in. And so, you know, again, the arts are a sort of full package and a museum is part of that mix. And so, again, we see a lot of understanding and support from our elected officials and our civic leaders about that.
And the weekend is coming up. Any suggestions to listeners on how they might celebrate Creative Economy Week here in Wisconsin?
Well, the culmination of Creative Economy Week is not only the week ending, but it's it is Armed Forces Day. So it's a museums around the state have a program where members of the military can go to museums without charge, and that's a nationwide program. It's the annual downtown open house where businesses and arts institutions and everything in a community in a downtown are opening their doors for people to experience. So we want people to get out and experience a museum and experience their community.
We'll leave it there for now. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Anne Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin. She was with us to talk about the economic impact of museums. That's the theme of this year's Creative Economy Week. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, John Munson and his guest mark the 10th anniversary of the Little Free Library, created here in Wisconsin and spreading around the country. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Trump administration continues to make a push for returning astronauts to the moon, only now it wants to get there sooner. Originally, the NASA budget called for a lunar landing in 2028. This week, the White House asked Congress for more money to speed up that timetable. Now they're aiming for 2024. At a summit in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said the goal is actually bigger than the moon.
We're going to the moon because we want to get to Mars with humans. If we want to learn more than we've ever learned before about Mars, we need to get there with humans.
So why the quest to get to the moon and Mars? Robert Walker is a former Republican congressman from Pennsylvania. He chaired the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee and the President's Commission on the Future of the U.S. Aerospace Industry. He's now the CEO of Moonwalker Associates, which lobbies for space and technology clients. He also wrote a piece for The Hill about why he supports the President's call for a space force to protect the U.S. from attacks in orbit. We'll get to that in a moment as well. Mr. Walker, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Nice to be with you.
Let's start with this idea of bringing people back to the moon. It's been quite a long time, almost 5 decades. Why now go back?
Well, because what we're learning about the moon is that the resources there may benefit us tremendously here on Earth, and certainly will benefit us as we go out to explore the rest of the solar system. Remember, the president's mission here is even bigger than Jim Bridenstine talked about. In the president's campaign, his policy was that we would explore the entire solar system with humans within the century. And so this is a very expansive view of what we need to do in the future, and it starts with the moon.
Now, a common argument against this kind of exploration is that, yes, it sounds nice, but we've got bigger priorities. The money could be better spent within Earth's atmosphere. What do you say to that concern?
Well, that's always the case, that somebody wants to spend the money right here, right now, instead of looking into the future. I think that's penny wise, pound foolish. When you look back at the moon program, it paid anywhere from 7 to 1 to 40 to 1 back to our economy for what we did in the previous moon program that landed the Apollo astronauts. You know, those figures depend upon who's calculating them. But there's no doubt that there was a huge help to our economy. Much of what we do now with miniaturization of technology started as a result of what we had to do in order to get to the moon. We have learned so much more about our universe because of the new techniques that we built during the moon program. We know that the technology that we used to go to the moon also helped us then build the space shuttles and move to a space station. That space station is now doing tremendous work in medical research and in materials research that may result in huge breakthroughs in both of those areas. And so this is not just about the future. It's about what we get back in our economy and in our lives today.
Now, what do you think about timeline? That NASA budget submitted in March, $10.7 billion for an exploration campaign that includes a moon landing in 2028. This week's request now, $1.5 billion plus to bump that up to 2024. Is it worth paying extra to bump it up by 4 years?
Yeah, it definitely is, because what we've learned about the NASA programs is that if you don't get them completed within one administration, the chances are that a new administration comes in, revises the programs, and then what you do is you end up stretching them out. We've been building a system called the Space Launch System, which is a massive rocket that started back as a part of a program in 2006, and we still haven't flown it. Meantime, companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX are much closer. SpaceX flies the rockets now. Blue Origin is in the process of building very large spacecraft that they're going to fly. It hasn't taken them 20 years to get there, or in this case, 15 years. We have a James Webb telescope that we started working on back when I was still in the Congress. That's over 21 years ago. And we still haven't flown the James Webb telescope. And so what you've got to have is you've got to have a program that an administration commits itself to and finishes inside that administration.
Talking to former Congressman Robert Walker about U.S. space policy, efforts to get to the moon by 2024, people on Mars after that. And, Mr. Walker, let's talk about now the military and space, the president calling for a separate, distinct military command to handle operations and security in space. What do you see? You've written in favor of this. What do you see of the benefits of, you know, taking it out of the control of the Air Force and other agencies?
Well, it'll be a force that focuses exclusively on the space matters. Right now, we don't have one of our military branches that focuses exclusively there. Each of the military branches sees space as a tremendous asset to them. They see it as absolutely essential to their mission, but their mission is not space. Their mission is air, land, or sea. And so they don't focus exclusively there. What we know now is that we're at war every day in space. We have satellites chasing satellites in space. We have our adversaries developing offensive weapons and defensive weapons in space. We know that what we need to have is an ability to have an asymmetric advantage when we go to war and when we have emergencies arise. And our adversaries are trying to take that away from us. We need a force that's organized and equipped and trained to do the space mission.
We heard on Facebook from Brandy. Brandy writes, if the military protects our land, air, and water, a space force implies that space is ours to protect. What do other countries think of this? Brandy asks. So we don't. There aren't borders in space. Do we have the authority, the legitimacy to militarize in space?
Well, there aren't borders on the sea either, and we have had a Navy that has done international work from the very beginning of it. And some of the things that apply to the law of the sea also will apply to space. And what we're defending out there is the assets which we have put into space. We're defending our own assets in space. We're not trying to claim all of space for the United States.
Now, what, on a practical level, would a space force look like? Clearly, it would not be people, for the most part, in orbit itself. This would be work done from the ground.
Right. It's going to be a reasonably small force, and that's one of the criticisms is, why do you need a force that it would be so much smaller than, for instance, the Coast Guard or the Marines? And the answer is because these are highly trained technical people. They are people who we don't need vast numbers of, but we need the very skills that they possess. And allowing them to focus on that mission and that mission alone will assure that we have the right kind of activity in space.
We're talking about Trump administration policies for space, Earth's orbit and beyond, with Robert Walker, a former Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, chair then of the House Science, Space and Technology Committee. He's now a lobbyist for space and technology clients. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the United States be trying to land people on the moon again as soon as 6 years or so from now? Is it a worthwhile mission? What do you think about President Trump's call for a separate military command to deal with issues in Earth's orbit? Do we need that? Is it okay as it is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about President Trump's space policy priorities with Robert Walker, a former congressman who chaired the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee. He also chaired the President's Commission on the Future of the U.S. Aerospace Industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The President and others making the case that we need to land people on the moon again, one step on the way to having people go to Mars in the future and maybe beyond. What do you think about that? And what do you think about the idea of a new military command? The President has called it a space force to deal with concerns, issues in Earth's orbit. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page with this separate military command. Mr. Walker, some in Congress have raised concerns, not so much about the mission, but about the costs, the idea of creating a new separate bureaucracy, the Congressional Budget Office saying, hey, this is going to cost more than the White House is saying. What would you say to those your colleagues now, your present colleagues in Congress?
Well, we have a $19 trillion economy, which is at risk because we are not adequately protecting our assets in space. This amount of money would amount to about, even if you take the biggest number that the Congressional Budget Office came up with, it would amount to about 0.7% of the money that we spend on defense. Now, you know, if we can't afford that to protect a $19 trillion economy, we're in pretty sad shape.
Now, we heard from Amber on Facebook. She writes, as a science fiction enthusiast, I like the idea. She's talking about the military command here. As a taxpayer and someone who's concerned with rising tensions between the countries, I'm pessimistic about how the program would be applied by our government and how the rest of the world perceives it. So concerns about an arms race in space, in part if we have this separate military command devoted to orbital operations.
Well, there's already an arms race in space. As I said earlier, we have satellites chasing satellites. We have anti-satellite weapons. Our adversaries, Russia and China in particular, are putting offensive weapons into space. All of this is taking place as we speak. Space has become a combat zone. And so we need to recognize that in our own policies. The fact is that we are the most prominent nation in space. Our adversaries would like to take that away from us. And I'm old enough to remember when Sputnik went up and we panicked as a nation because the Russians had put this small satellite into space. Imagine what we'll have if the Chinese land on the moon and claim the moon, because we don't have a lot of laws at the present time. The people who get there first may well be able to claim it. We didn't do that when we went, but the Chinese well could do that in the future.
Along those lines, do you think that there needs to be more work in the international community to try to set up laws that govern who can claim what and do what in space, in the orbit, on the moon and beyond?
I absolutely do. I think we ought to have some international agreements about the behavior of people who are spacefaring nations, about how the laws govern people who are no longer a part of a defined national territory. There are all kinds of things that we should do, and we probably ought to use the law of the sea as a starting point and then develop a law that recognizes that we have now gone beyond our own planet.
When it comes to long-term planning for space policy, as you mentioned, each new administration kind of shakes up the timetables and agendas. Do you see the possibility of some bipartisan work in Congress to set a longer-term policy that maybe whoever the next president is could get behind?
Well, I would hope so. And I think the last couple of presidents, at least, have hoped that they had done that. And then it simply fell apart. The next administration went its own way. I think one of the reasons why you want to get to the moon and establish a permanent presence there is that that pretty much assures that you're going to have to keep that in place. It's happened with the space station. Once the space station was being built and once it was finished, each administration has committed the resources necessary to keep the space station operating. And so the reason to get something done is because it becomes a part of our permanent space establishment then.
Now, you've been in Congress. You see how Congress is working today or not in some cases. Are you optimistic that there will be agreements reached on things like the NASA funding the president is looking for and on the creation of a separate military command for space?
Well, I think that's an open question at this point. I think it's going to be very difficult to get some of the money that that NASA is looking for. Hopefully, people will recognize that this is a mission that really does speak to the future. On the Space Force side, I think Congress is probably going to develop some kind of a Space Force policy. I don't think it will necessarily track exactly what the administration has proposed, but I think at the end of the day, the recognition of how serious the problem is that we have will cause the Congress to recognize the need to put a Space Force in place.
In our last few moments, we're talking the moon in maybe 5 or 10 years, depending on which plan we go with. Do you have thoughts on a timetable for people on Mars?
Well, I don't think that that will happen before the 2030s. I think we're probably at least that far away. What you don't have in the calculation is some people may decide to go there, whether the government decides to go there or not. I mean, Elon Musk is developing a huge rocket called the Starship that he intends to use to go to Mars. Who knows? He may get there before NASA has a program to do so. Jeff Bezos with the Blue Origin company is developing a couple of huge rockets that are capable certainly of going to the moon, and which is his prime goal, but ultimately could also be used as Mars vehicles.
We'll leave it there for now. Mr. Walker, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Nice to be with you.
It's Robert Walker, former Republican congressman from Pennsylvania. He chaired the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee and the President's Commission on the Future of the U.S. Aerospace Industry. He's now a lobbyist for space and technology clients. Talked to them about the President's call for the U.S. to return to the moon in 2024. And he also made the case for the President's proposed Space Force as a necessary step to keeping America safe. Wisconsin is known far and wide for its beer culture, and in recent years, Wisconsin's political culture has gotten a lot of national attention, too. But as Brady Carlson reports for our series High Tolerance, beer culture has long been a part of Wisconsin politics.
Milwaukee was in the mood to celebrate the day Democratic Party Chair Tom Perez came to announce the city would host the 2020 Democratic National Convention. The celebration was very Wisconsin, a beer toast. Only as the glasses clinked together and cameras clicked, things got messy. They spilled beer on the paperwork. Not intentional, but for those in Wisconsin politics, also not surprising.
It's a shorthand and quick way to convey something by having a beer.
That's political scientist Mordecai Lee of UW-Milwaukee. He says for out-of-state politicians looking to show they're in touch with Wisconsin culture, a beer is a way to do it.
You know, it's not that different from, I don't know, campaigning in Chicago and having a Chicago hot dog or a deep dish pizza. For politicians, the sort of simplistic, stereotypical instant messaging that happens with a photo op with beer, they continue doing it.
National figures have done it a lot. Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and First Lady Betty Ford, just to name a few. The pictures of candidates raising glasses of Wisconsin beer are a timeline of American politics. Lee points to a visit from Ronald Reagan, who used his beer photo op to make a point to the state's conservative voters.
Sitting next to him is the police chief of Milwaukee, who was identified with conservative politics, even though he personally was a civil servant and couldn't do an endorsement. And here was a situation where Ronald Reagan was able to convey several things at the same time.
In-state politicians recognize the value of a campaign beer, too, though their take on the tradition is perhaps less cynical.
On the national level, having a beer with a politician is a cliche. In Wisconsin, having a beer with a politician is a way of life.
That's Brian Reisinger, who worked on campaigns for top state Republicans like U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and former Governor Scott Walker. He says on the campaign trail, you go where people are. Festival beer tents, breweries, bars, even tailgate parties outside Lambeau Field.
It's kind of hard to take part in the beer on a setting like that because you're warm and you've got hours of walking to do and it could go badly for you. But you get cheersed a lot. You get a lot of toasts.
And you can get a lot of attention, like when Ron Johnson's campaign released a video of the senator partaking in...
It was a chug.
Johnson downed a Miller Lite in seconds, apparently impressing the bartender.
That's pretty good.
And getting plenty of attention in news and social media, the kind of attention Reisinger says campaigns dream about.
It was one of those moments where it didn't really matter what your politics were. You just were like, hey, that's cool. That senator just slammed a beer like my buddy would on Friday night. And it was a way for people to relate to him. And it was the best thing about it was a real moment. We never could have scripted or come up with it. It just happened.
Bridging political divides with beer doesn't always work, judging by the protests outside the bipartisan Beer and Brat Summit Governor Scott Walker held after the 2012 recall campaign. And pouring a beer can backfire, as Hillary Clinton learned during a 2016 primary event. Tammy Plourd of Pearl Street Brewery in La Crosse was there.
You know, I kind of gave her the lowdown. You know, you got to pull the tap handle all the way forward. You can't half do it. But she just didn't pull the tap handle all the way forward, and that just created a lot of foam.
The campaign trail increasingly runs through craft breweries like Pearl Street. Candidates can pay tribute to Wisconsin's beer history and highlight small businesses at the same time. But craft beer is growing across the country. Will Wisconsin's blend of beer and politics still stand out? Tammy Plourd says yes, because to her, these moments aren't just about the beer.
Wisconsin's very good at being down home, very relatable, very friendly, and we just kind of want to experience all that together. And I think Wisconsin will always stand out for that.
And if that doesn't work and the beer and politics connection goes out of state, Mordecai Lee has an idea to keep candidates coming here.
I'm guessing the incoming product that's going to replace it is going to be cheese. After all, we're already called cheeseheads, and our motto is America's Dairyland.
If nothing else, you can't quite spill cheese on a contract the way you can with a beer. Brady Carlson, WPR News.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a bunch of states have passed new high-profile restrictions on abortion with an eye toward the courts and legal precedent for the future. Look at the history and politics of abortion laws and how the latest news fits in. In our continuing series on alcohol in the state, we'll look at the human cost of drunk driving crashes. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll get the inside story on buttermilk and how we can use it for lots and lots of different recipes. It has a million uses, or so I'm told. I'll be educated tomorrow on Food Friday. That and look at some of the top news stories from around the state. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.